Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Lenny.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Christy Middleton, Senior Food Policy Director for the Humane Society of the United States and author of Meat Less, Transform the Way You Eat and Live, One Meal at a Time. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
The Center for Biological Diversity and several Texas-based conservation organizations petitioned the Texas State's Parks and Wildlife Department to end commercial trapping of the state's wild turtles. Under current Texas law, turtle trappers can collect unlimited numbers of four turtle species on private lands to sell domestically or to export for international food and medicine markets. This is putting turtle populations, already facing pollution and habitat loss, at risk across the state. According to Jenny Loda, an attorney and biologist at the center, for-profit turtle trappers shouldn't be allowed to drive the state's turtles to the brink of extinction. She also notes that scientists have concluded that even modest commercial trapping of freshwater turtles can lead to population crashes. For the sake of our native turtles, Texas needs to stop this exploitative trapping. More than 2,000 freshwater turtles were trapped in Texas over the past 2 years. According to reports submitted by holders of non-game dealer permits to the Parks and Wildlife Department, international food and medicinal markets drive most of the trade. Because turtles accumulate toxins from prey in their bodies and burrow into contaminated sediments, their meat is often laced with mercury, PCBs, and pesticides, posing a health risk. Adult turtles are also taken from the wild to breed hatchlings for the international pet trade. Texas modified its regulation in 2007 to protect freshwater turtles from harvest on its public lands and waters. However, this only resulted in protections for turtles in 2.2% of water bodies in Texas. Under current law, unlimited harvest of four native freshwater turtle species is allowed on private property in the state. Recent studies concluded that the current turtle harvest regulations in Texas are not likely to be sustainable. Texas is a regional hotspot for commercial turtle collectors, and reform is needed. If the state created closed seasons and bag limits within its borders, adjacent states would likely follow its example. The region would be better equipped to protect its turtle populations by making it clearer to turtle traders that trade is strictly regulated and enforced. The center also recently petitioned for a ban on unlimited commercial trapping in Louisiana and in Oklahoma, two states that share a border with Texas. Let's help stop this practice. See the Center for Biological Diversity for more information.
On Monday, June 5th, the Trump administration authorized five companies to search for oil off the Atlantic coast using loud seismic air gun blasts that hurt whales, dolphins, and other animals. Kristen Monsell, an attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity, said, "Deafening whales and dolphins to hunt for dirty oil in these sensitive coastal environments is reckless and cruel. It's outrageous that the Trump administration is catering to big oil by ignoring the needs of wildlife and coastal communities." The proposals would allow the firing of seismic air guns from ships every 10 seconds, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, at a noise level 100,000 times more intense than a jet engine, a level that would rupture human eardrums. Whales and dolphins navigate and communicate by their biological sonar, and they would be crippled and killed by these seismic blasts. Nearly 100 cities from New Jersey to Florida have adopted resolutions rejecting seismic blasting off the East Coast, and more than 40,000 East Coast businesses have publicly opposed it, citing threats to marine life and local economies. Earlier this year, the Obama administration denied six applications for seismic exploration in the Atlantic, in part because the loud blast would harm critically endangered North Atlantic right whales, of which fewer than 500 individuals remain. But in May, the Trump administration revoked that denial and announced it was reconsidering the permits in another example of Trump's attempts to undo all of Obama's accomplishments and benefit environmentally destructive special interest businesses. Will this move fulfill Trump's pipe dream of creating more jobs? I don't think so. It will create more money for oil and gas executives, but it will destroy the jobs of whale and dolphin watching cruise businesses and people involved in ocean-based tourism, and it will end the jobs of many cetacean scientists who study the diminishing number of these animals. But perhaps it will create jobs in other countries that are more progressive than we are about green energy and protecting the planet.
From the online newsletter, The Dodo, Ringling Brothers Circus just held its last show ever last month, but life could be getting even worse for the circus's tigers. Feld Entertainment, the parent company behind Ringling Brothers, has applied for a permit to ship 8 of its tigers overseas to a circus in Germany instead of retiring them to a sanctuary. In the notice, Ringling claims the tigers would serve to enhance the propagation or survival of the species, a requirement put in place by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to ensure endangered species, like tigers, are only shipped for conservation purposes. But according to the Animal Legal Defense Fund, this requirement doesn't always receive the scrutiny it deserves. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has historically taken a controversial pay-to-play approach to the enhancement requirement, often rubber-stamping permits for objectionable uses of endangered species, so long as the applicant makes a nominal donation to a conservation program. It's well established that the use of tigers in circuses fails to educate the public and has no nexus to legitimate species conservation. In fact, many experts opine that the use of exotic animals for entertainment acts and other traveling shows is harmful to their wild counterparts. The announcement comes as a blow to animal lovers throughout the country, many of whom hope that Ringling's January decision to close its doors for good would mean its animals would finally be able to retire to more natural lives after years of mistreatment. Ringling Brothers has been dogged by accusations of animal abuse for decades, ranging from suspicious deaths of elephants to the brutal training methods used on young calves who had been torn away from their mothers. But while most of the public attention has focused on the plight of Ringling's elephants, the circus's big cats were living an equally depressive life. But now it seems the tigers' future is even more murky. If the permit is approved, the 8 tigers will be sent to a circus in Munich that's had its own share of abuse accusations, including claims that many of the circus's animals, similarly to Ringling, are suffering from arthritis and mental distress and are denied proper living conditions. In a statement, the Animal Legal Defense Fund said it strongly opposes Ringling efforts to condemn these tigers to continued exploitation for entertainment when there are humane options for the endangered animals. For now, the best hope is that the public outcry will prevent U.S. Fish and Wildlife from approving the permit request. You have the right to comment on the permit application, and the 30-day comment window is now open. For guidelines on how to register your formal comment, please visit ALDF.org. Stay with us. Coming up next is a conversation with Christy Middleton, Senior Food Policy Director for the Humane Society of the United States and a leading figure in the movement to reform our global food system. She's partnered with some of the nation's biggest school districts to implement Meatless Monday, and she's helped some of America's top universities develop and implement programs to add more plant-based options to their menus and train culinary staff in plant-based food prep. Middleton holds a certificate in plant-based nutrition from T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies, and her work has been covered by the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, CNN, and countless others. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Christy Middleton. Thanks for being with us, Christy.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Christy, can you start out by telling our listeners how you got involved in animal issues and veganism?
I'd be happy to. So actually, in my book, Meatless, Transform the Way You Eat and Live One Meal at a Time, I start the book talking a little bit about this. So I grew up in Chesapeake, Virginia, which is just on the North Carolina border. I would consider it the South. And I grew up eating the standard American diet. My sister and I had 3 dogs, Pete, Casey, and Tinkerbell, who we just adored. Wherever we went, they were there with us, whether we were riding our bikes around the neighborhood or vegging out in front of MTV, which was new at the time. those dogs were there with us. And so as a little girl, I loved animals. And one day my sister said to me as I was about to dig into a plate of scrambled eggs, "You know what those are, right? Dead baby birds." So, yeah, that left me reeling, and I stopped eating eggs as a little girl. I would still eat them in some of my favorite foods like cakes and cookies because I didn't really put 2 and 2 together. But it wasn't until I was in college when I became vegetarian, and that's when one of my marketing professors was describing euphemisms. And the example that she gave was meat. And she said, if instead of calling it meat, which is this tidy package that we put this term into, we called it what it really is, which is the flesh of dead animals. Probably a lot fewer people would want to eat it. And she was right, at least in my case, because after that, when I would sit down to eat, that's what I would think about. I would think, this is not just a ham sandwich, this is the flesh of a dead pig. So I became vegetarian, but even then, I knew nothing about factory farming. I had no idea about battery cages, which I imagine many of your listeners are familiar with, which is the real problem with eggs, that we are confining egg-laying hens in tiny cages by the hundreds of millions, which deprives them the ability to do anything that's important or natural to them. I didn't know about gestation crates that prevent mother pigs from even turning around for the duration of their pregnancy. And so after becoming vegetarian, I started doing research. I started volunteering with PETA, which had popped up there in my hometown when I was in college, and I was just blown away. I couldn't believe the way that we institutionally abuse animals by the billions, and that's when I decided that I would become vegan and devote my life to helping animals, and I've been very fortunate to be able to do this work ever since.
Yeah, it's great. It is really inspiring to hear stories like that, how, you know, people take it to their heart when they come to terms with the cruelty that we do inflict on these animals, because so many people are unable to open their eyes to that kind of shocking realization of what they're actually doing each time they bite into a cheeseburger or I love bacon or whatever. You know, it's just like, you know, they just close their eyes to it.
Right, which is why what you're doing is so important, helping shed a bright spotlight on the way that we do abuse animals in our society and the good work that people are doing to end that suffering and end the cruelty and how individuals can do their part as well.
Glad to hear that your sister did her sisterly duty and tried to gross you out.
She definitely did, and I'm very proud to report that years later, after I became vegan and, you know, was very dogmatic about it, and I've since taken a little more subtle approach, but she and her entire family are vegetarian, so, you know, what comes around goes around.
Nice. She wasn't vegetarian at the time, huh?
No, she was not. We were both little girls, like probably around 9, 11, something like that.
Happily chomping on baby birds.
Exactly.
well, you know, I just wanted to revisit it real quick. In the book, you talk about a story where you're helping your husband with rescuing some spent egg-laying hens. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, because I think for most of us, you know, in Texas and everywhere else, we really just are removed from our food and don't really understand, to go back to your point about the conditions that battery hens are in, or battery cage hens live their lives. What was your experience there?
Right. Well, I was actually not in the farm itself. We were helping a sanctuary that had received some spent egg-laying hens. For those listeners who aren't familiar with the term, it's the term that the egg industry uses when egg-laying hens are no longer productive. And those spent hens tend to just be destroyed, maybe by being gassed to death, or worse, sometimes there have been stories of them being basically ground up alive because they're essentially of no use to the industry any longer. But some fortunate hens from time to time are rescued by animal sanctuaries, and we were working with Animal Place in Northern California and Harvest Home Sanctuary, which is also a much smaller sanctuary in Stockton, California, and they had received word from a local egg farm that gave them permission to take some of the egg-laying hens, essentially as many as they could provide sanctuary for. And so we were there on the receiving end during the transport, and we helped with transporting them from one place to the next. And the hens, as I describe in the book, I mean, these are animals who have personalities, they're sensitive, they're living beings, and they arrive with feathers missing. Some of them are missing eyes. They're clearly in distress. This is the first time they have ever been able to fully extend their wings without touching another bird or the inside of the cages in which they have been confined for about 18 months. So it's bittersweet, honestly, because your heart breaks knowing that these animals have known nothing but suffering for their lives prior to that. But then you get to see them take their first steps to be able to flap those wings, which they immediately start doing and start pecking around and investigating their surroundings, which is what chickens do when they're able to do so. So as I said, it's bittersweet. It was really heartwarming to be able to be there and take part in that process. but I wish that other people could see what that's like, what the condition that the egg-laying hens show up in, because I imagine if that were the case, if people could see those conditions, that far fewer people would want to eat eggs.
I was a vegetarian for like 20 years before I finally went vegan, because I was happy with the notion, oh, I'm not killing anything for my eggs and milk. And then, you know, eventually I came to realize it took a long time. The animals that provide eggs and milk are actually suffer a lot more than those that produce meat.
Right, yeah, about 30 hours of suffering just to lay one single egg. And so now I'm very fortunate to have a couple of chickens as next-door neighbors. Well, I have humans as next-door neighbors as well, but they have a couple of hens. And they come over every single day because they realize that I'm a sucker and will give out food for their visits. And it's really fun to get to know these individuals. One of them is pretty shy, but she really comes over when the blueberries come out. And the other wants to come over every day and just investigate my yard. And again, you know, think about these animals as individuals rather than these hundreds of millions of beings. Even as activists, it's hard for us to put our minds around that and to recognize that we're talking about individual beings. But, you know, when you do have that opportunity to interact and engage with one, I think you really do get a better idea of how they are all individuals with lives and needs and desires of their own and personalities of their own. So it's been a real joy getting to know them.
Well, one thing I want to kind of point out too is that one of our friends here in El Paso adopted some chickens that I guess a young kid from FAA was raising, and he had kept them not in a battery cage, but in a, you know, one of these backyard chicken cages. And, you know, then people are like, well, you know, they have a much better life, these backyard chickens. But when they adopted these chickens and they let them onto the ground, it was obvious they'd never been on the ground before. They had been in those slightly bigger cages their whole entire life. And they like went crazy rolling around in the dirt and pecking, like you said, and flapping their wings. So I think there's some misconception, too, about like birds that are raised quote, cage-free or in the backyard industries, too, because, I mean, maybe the conditions are slightly better, but I don't think it's, you know, tremendously better. And, of course, the end is the same.
Right. Yes, I would never say that it's chicken paradise. And I actually have a whole section in the book excerpted from the Humane Society of the United States website on those labels, because I think that they can be very confusing, especially for consumers who are confronted with dozens of decisions every time they go to the grocery store. And so cage-free, it's something that the Humane Society, we work on corporate outreach, working with big food companies like McDonald's, Burger King, Walmart, et cetera. And we advocate for cage-free as a minimum standard for them to purchase from their egg suppliers, which we think is a modicum of better treatment. It's certainly, again, not egg, you know, paradise for egg-laying hens, but it's better than being unable to even fully extend their wings. But it is really confusing, and again, cage-free just means that they're able to be in a giant warehouse. They're not able to go outside. They're not able to take a breath of fresh air, but in the very least, they have nesting boxes, perches, and a few other amenities. So it can be very confusing, and I think for anybody who wants to know, you know, wants to have some kind of assurance that the animals in their food supply are being treated humanely, then I think it's really important that you see that for yourself and decide if that's a system that you are comfortable supporting. And I imagine for most people, the answer would be no.
Right. Speaking of labels that mislead consumers, I saw a news item today that the animal agriculture lobby is trying to get vegan meat products to stop calling their products meat. The same thing happened, you know, with milk. The dairy industry wanted soy milk and almond milk to quit using the word milk. And now they're going after vegan meats.
Yeah, you know, as it did with the milk standards, and it did with Hampton Creek when you know, they were using the term mayo. Uh-huh. And the FDA got involved and said that they couldn't use that. And it's really interesting to see the food industry been taking every opportunity to fight the progress that I think is inevitable,
right,
based on recent history, because, you know, we see that the plant-based milk industry is booming, while on the other hand, dairy milk is lagging in sales.
Uh-huh.
And so it's exciting to see many companies like Dean Foods, which bought out Silk, Dean Foods being one of the largest dairies in the world, now buying out Silk soy milk, and many other companies like Tyson Foods investing in Beyond Meat, because
right,
they realize that the future of protein is going to be very different than it is today. And so, you know what, I really take comfort in that, and I think that there are a lot of mixed feelings that people have. But if you think about it, these are businesses that just want to make money. And so if they see that there's profitability in plant-based foods and they pivot their model so that they are now engaging in that market that's better for our health, that's better for the planet, that's better for the animals who are caught up in the food system, then I think that we should all be supportive and excited about that kind of progress. But yeah, the labeling issue is one that's very, very timely, and we keep seeing it resurface. But my hope is that instead of fighting this progress, that the ag industry will get behind it and recognize that there's some business opportunities there.
Well, Christy, it seems like, you know, after some of the suffering that we've discussed and the learning about the impact of the meat-based diet on the environment and on people's health, a lot of our guests in the past, you know, obviously push for or have books about veganism. Yours is unique and meatless and offering, you know, concrete reasons for reducing meat consumption. What made you decide to try to go after the audience of people who are on the fence and maybe just finding a way to get them to slowly decrease their meat consumption? What inspired that move?
Yeah, so, you know, in my day job, I work for the Humane Society of the United States, and what my team does, we have about 20 people who are working across the country in different regions, and we help institutions, schools, hospitals, colleges, and universities. We've worked with the military, we've worked with some correctional facilities, and we work with them to reduce the amount of meat they're putting on their menus and add more plant-based options. And I feel like this work is incredibly important because a single school district like Los Angeles Unified, which we help do a Meatless Monday, serves 700,000 meals a day. So once a week now, those 700,000 meals are meatless, which over the course of just one school year means about 4.6 million fewer animals who will be served by that school district. So this reduction message, which I think is very compelling for many people who feel like change is overwhelming, and I think it, you know, for most of us, we would say that it is overwhelming, but that by doing something small, we can all collectively make a big difference. And so, you know, I kept hearing this throughout my work within the industry, is that they liked Meatless Monday because it helped their guests with recognizing that they don't need meat at the center of their plate every single day, every single meal. And so we got lots of institutions on board with it. And along the way, met many individuals who were very new to this issue and who I think if we had told to go vegan or add vegan options and not to, you know, do this gradually, would have not engaged with us or not talked with us. So I felt like there was an opportunity there for individuals, readers all across the country, to maybe think about it in terms of shrinking the change into a smaller bite-sized step, which is what I encourage in the book, is, you know, you can certainly stop with Meatless Monday. That would still make a difference. But if you want to get to vegan or you want to get to vegetarian, then do it gradually because it tends to be more sustainable.
And I think the beauty of the school districts, too, is it's exposing, you know, our future generations to the same idea that they can, that they can and they do eat meals all the time without meat and they can be healthy. Do you know about how many schools or school districts have Meatless Mondays?
Well, we've worked with over 200 school districts across the country, including several in Texas. We've worked with the Houston Independent School District, which is doing a meatless Lean and Green Monday. We work with Dallas ISD, McAllen, which is on the border, and Fort Worth Public Schools, and their school food service department is right down the street from the Stockyards. So it's really exciting to see school districts all across the country and some unexpected areas that are embracing this notion. And as you said, it's not just the meals that they're serving there in school. They're also part of educating the students. You know, the education doesn't stop when the kids leave the classroom and go into the cafeteria. They're being exposed to new ideas, to new ways of eating. And now for this current generation, meatless eating is going to be part of their culture. And so it's really exciting to see all of these school districts embrace this concept.
So what kind of education do they get along with the lunches?
Some of the schools will put up posters and signage. They might put information on their website. They may do programming. We have videos that many schools will share on their morning announcements or put on a website as well. There's not a ton of time for nutrition education, which is unfortunate, but we see a variety of interventions. A school district that I work with here in Northern California, where I'm currently based, Novato Unified, they've been doing Meatless Monday for many years, and they also teamed up with a local dietitian who teaches nutrition classes, and she has a class for the parents and for kids. So it's really cool because the kids come home from school, they're excited about the foods that they've eaten, and then they get the parents to learn how to cook and prepare those foods, and they're teaching them plant-based food. So it's really cool to see things like that happening all across the country.
And what I thought was neat too, in your book, you mentioned that Meatless Monday was initiated by the U.S. Food Administration during World War I as a resource conservation campaign. I couldn't believe that.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people don't realize the history that this was actually a U.S. government initiated campaign. So it was done because even back then, they realized that meat production is incredibly resource intensive. It requires a lot of input. So instead of feeding grains to animals, we could just use them directly. And so Americans here were encouraged to go meat free one day a week to support the troops abroad. And it was brought back during World War II for the same reason. And then in 2003 by the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, an organization called the Mondays Campaign, which was doing it at that time to fight a war on chronic disease. And so since then, as I mentioned, we've worked with over 200 school districts, hundreds of universities, and even hospitals to implement these programs in a way that works for them and their guests.
Well, Christy, unfortunately, we've barely scratched the surface on your book and all the resources that it provides and information about why to eat less meat and recipes and things like that. But where can our listeners go to pick up the books themselves and see your great work?
Thank you. So my book is available on major booksellers, so Amazon, Barnes & Noble, as well as independent bookstores all across the country, and you can visit indiebound.com to find one that sells it. And I'll just wrap up by sharing that the book was written for people who are interested in eating less meat. So for your listeners who have friends or family members who maybe not ready to go 100% vegan, I think it makes a great gift or a great resource for them to better understand the implications of our diets and how we can all play a role in improving the welfare of animals, improving environmental sustainability, and improving our health.
We've been talking with Christy Middleton, Senior Food Policy Director for the Humane Society of the United States and author of Meat Less, Transform the Way You Eat and Live, One Meal at a Time. Thanks for being with us, Christy.
Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Christy. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Here in El Paso, as the temperatures start to reach the triple digits, remember not to leave your companion animal outside with adequate food and water and shelter from the sun. Also, it's never a good idea to leave a pet in a car.
If you'd like to learn more about plant-based eating, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's website at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the listen button. Until next time, I'm Tom Linney.
I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.